Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. The Oklahoma legislature just completed its annual session, and progress was made in a number of areas that are healthcare related. These mostly revolve around slightly increased budgets for a number of programs addressing both mental illness and people with disabilities, which, as my guest today will tell you, is a good start but doesn't go far enough in addressing the problems. In addition, there's been significant discussion at many levels, from the legislature to the business community to advocacy groups, about the possibility of Medicaid expansion in Oklahoma. We'll review what Medicaid is, what expanding it would do, and what the benefits of Medicaid expansion have been in the 36 other states that have taken the 90% federal match to provide broader coverage to their populations. My guest today is Carly Putnam, Policy Director and Health Policy Analyst at the Oklahoma Policy Institute, based here in Tulsa. Putnam is a graduate of the University of Tulsa, where she majored in sociology and women's studies. She took a paid internship with Oklahoma Policy Institute about 6 years ago when it had only four staffers. Now it has 20, and she's been with them ever since. Carly Putnam, Policy Director and Health Policy Analyst at the Oklahoma Policy Institute, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Carly Putnam, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by talking about Medicaid, since that's always a front and center issue in Oklahoma health policy. We're one of the minority of states that has not expanded Medicaid and don't appear to be on the cusp of doing so, although our new governor, Kevin Stitt, has mentioned that he is at least considering the idea or an Oklahoma version of Medicaid expansion. Tell us, what are the benefits of Medicaid expansion as you see it from your research?
Yeah, so the effects of coverage expansion are pretty far-reaching and also pretty broad. And as you know, when it comes to healthcare research, it can take a long time to start to see, you know, real evidence and data, because it takes a long time for interventions to intervene and then for the effects to be measurable. So I can't say that coverage expansion is the silver bullet that will fix all of our healthcare problems, but I can say that it seems to indicate that it's a really good start. The first and probably most obvious, but you still got to say it, thing that coverage expansion or Medicaid expansion does is it lowers the uninsured rate, and it does so significantly. States like Kentucky and Arkansas, when they first expanded Medicaid, saw their uninsured rates cut in half. To date, Oklahoma has the second highest uninsured rate in the U.S. We are behind Texas and I think tied with Georgia, which are fun states. They are good states to party with. They're not ones that you really want to model your health care policy after. And we also have the fourth highest child uninsured rate in the U.S., behind, I think, Alaska, Texas, and Wyoming, which, same statement on fun states, but not ones that you want to model health policy after.
So there's this entity, CHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program, which I thought made it so that no kid was going to be left uninsured,
really
at least kids.
Interesting thing, and the really unfortunate thing here, is that we know that parent health insurance coverage and child health insurance coverage are closely linked. So when parents get access to care, they're more likely to sign their kids up. The thing we run into in Oklahoma and other non-expansion states is lots of parents who don't know that their kids are eligible for coverage. And so when states expand coverage and these parents go to enroll, then they go, oh, hey, I can enroll my kid as well. And they do. And then their child gets access to health coverage. The Georgetown Center for Children and Families did a report back in November looking at health insurance rates of children, and found that of the 25 states with the highest child uninsured rate, 16 were expansion states. But of the 25 states with the lowest child uninsured rate, 23 had expanded coverage. So when you expand coverage, and we see this across pretty much all categories of health coverage, when you expand coverage to one group, others who were previously eligible but not enrolled get enrolled. And we call that the welcome mat effect. So paradoxically, one of the best things Oklahoma could do for the health of its kids would be to expand coverage to their parents and other adults.
So let's take a step back and just remind listeners what Medicaid is.
So Medicaid is the nation's leading health insurance program for low-income people. In Oklahoma, about one in four people are on Medicaid, and most of them are kids. Eligibility varies significantly by age, so the state has a pretty vested interest in children and pregnant women and the elderly, for instance. So people up to 200% of the federal poverty level can enroll, whereas the threshold for parents is much, much lower. It's about $8,000 a year for a single mother with one child, and that's about 46% of the federal poverty level. And then we don't actually have Medicaid access for childless adults who do not have significant disabilities at all. So the line I use is that if OK Policy went away tomorrow, knock on wood, I couldn't enroll in Medicaid. Me and my lungs that don't work would not be eligible for Medicaid coverage.
Because you're an adult without children, and you would, at
that
point,
significant disabilities.
But so then how do those disabilities get determined? I've always wondered that. I'm a physician. I still don't even know. But so you would go to some medical evaluator who would say this lung disease
SSI.
Is incapacitating?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you qualify for SSI, then you can get Medicaid.
Which is incredibly difficult. I've been working on this issue and coverage expansion for a long time, and we met a woman who has MS and epilepsy. She's also caring for her son, who has significant disabilities and actually is on Medicaid because of them. She herself has been denied 5 times now for disability.
Oh my goodness.
Right. And the most recent time was because she didn't have the paperwork showing that her disease had progressed, and she didn't have the paperwork because she's uninsured. So it becomes a sort of vicious catch-22. And there's often this understanding that people who have disabilities can just get on disability and then they're fine, and that is absolutely not the case. It's actually one of the things we've seen in states that have expanded coverage is that this is sort of both fascinating and horrifying. The employment rate for adults with disabilities goes up when states expand coverage because people with disabilities no longer have to essentially stay artificially poor in order to get and keep their health insurance.
So one thing that I've always wondered, and I just don't understand, and maybe you can help on this, is when the Affordable Care Act went into effect, the federal government agreed to pay, at the time it went into effect, 100%. But now, I guess in perpetuity, it's 90% of the cost of Medicaid. So Medicaid's always been a federal and state program, and states are on the hook for a significant portion of Medicaid. But if you expand Medicaid, 90% of the costs are picked up by the federal government. So we pay tax dollars to the federal government in Washington, and as Oklahomans, we don't get that money back to support our neighbors who need Medicaid. Why don't we expand Medicaid, or what's the reasons that are given for not expanding Medicaid?
I mean, sort of to rewind and talk about the funding piece for a minute, which is super important. Yeah, so Medicaid is a state-federal program, and the majority, at least in all states, at least 50% of overall Medicaid dollars are federal. And the exact proportion that the feds pay is calculated depending on how the state's economy is doing. It's very complicated. Right now, about 62% of Oklahoma's Medicaid funding is federal. But when states expand coverage, for the coverage expansion group, the feds will pay 90% of the costs forever. It would take a major act of Congress to change that. And as to why the state hasn't expanded coverage, I mean, there have been a lot of excuses over the years that, you know, we can't trust, quote unquote, I'm making air quotes here, the federal government to pay their share, but we rely on federal funding for so much else. And the state can easily build in a circuit breaker provision that says that if the feds ever renege on their side, then we can just freeze the program. There's no obligation for us to continue it. There's sort of been the suggestion that, you know, the state simply can't afford this. And the thing is, we've seen from the 36 other states that have moved ahead with expansion that that is simply not the case. Back in 2013, Governor Fallon's office actually engaged a health policy firm, Levitt Partners, to look into what expansion Oklahoma would look like. And that report was then kind of immediately shoved under the rug. But they found that in a number of areas, people who are currently getting like piecemeal acute coverage that's funded only by the state would then get access to comprehensive health coverage, 90% of which would be covered by the feds, and that as a result, the state would see savings.
So you told us that, and it stands to reason very logically, that if we expand Medicaid, there's a welcome mat effect, we get more people enrolled, and we drop the uninsured rate. To me, that sounds like a good thing. We have more people with insurance, more people able to go into the system. But the research also shows there are health benefits to Medicaid. It's not just getting people enrolled and getting people away from uninsured status, but there are actual health benefits. You mentioned maternal child, you mentioned elderly. Are there some of those you can cite? I mean, like longevity or fewer hospitalizations, things like that?
Yeah. So we've seen some studies that indicate that mortality decreases in expansion states. We've also seen some really promising data on the effects on maternal and infant health. Something that's worth noting is in this really low-income population, researchers have found, you know, women can, when they become pregnant, often become eligible for Medicaid, but not, you know, before they become pregnant. And so research on low-income women had found that fully 50% were uninsured before they became pregnant and got Medicaid, and that 55% were uninsured within 6 months of giving birth. And so what we see is during pregnancy care and then sort of immediately postpartum care, Medicaid is available in states like Oklahoma, But aside from that, it's really, really not. And when states have expanded coverage so women can enroll and stay enrolled and have access to health coverage, regardless of whether or not they're pregnant, that we see better outcomes for both mothers and children. And we see, especially, we're starting to close some of the disparities in outcomes by race. We've seen that, I think it was Arkansas had found that the share of babies born to Black mothers who were birth weight, very low birth weight, preterm or very preterm, decreased with expansion. And that the share of women who were getting sort of all suggested prenatal care increased, access to necessary screenings and vitamins goes up when women have care from the moment that they become pregnant, not when they realize that they are pregnant and then need to get enrolled.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Carly Putnam, who's policy director and a healthcare policy analyst for the Oklahoma Policy Institute. And we're talking about Medicaid in Oklahoma, the possibility of expansion and why we haven't. We're also going to talk about the just recently completed legislative session that occurred. Finishing up on Medicaid, what are some of the economic effects of Medicaid?
Significant. It's sort of logical when you think it through that when people have access to health coverage, it becomes a lot easier to, like, in millennial speak, to be a functional adult, to adult. And so we've seen everything from that Medicaid makes it easier for people to work and find work. Ohio did a pretty intense study of their expansion population and found that of people who were looking for work, getting Medicaid helped them continue looking for work, and that those who already had a job said that getting Medicaid helped them keep their job, which makes a lot of sense when you think it through. Like, I have asthma, and my boss will tell you that I am not a productive worker when I'm not getting treated for that asthma, right? If I forget to fill my Symbicort prescription, it becomes pretty apparent pretty quick. And so making sure that people have access to the care they need makes them more functional workers. It also likely makes them better parents. We know that Oklahoma takes adverse childhood experiences really seriously. And one ACE, as they're called, is having a parent with untreated mental illness. So making it much easier for parents to get the treatment they need makes it easier for them to parent and to be there for their kids when they need them.
And net result is fewer traumatic experiences for those children, and repetition of the cycle of traumatized children leading to traumatized adults.
Exactly. And, expansion really has a two-generation effect.
Another economic effect that I've read about is that a lot of people in the United States, unfortunately, because of the system or patchwork non-system that we have, wind up in what we call medical bankruptcy. That is, costs of their health care wind up exceeding what they have in savings, even when they have insurance, because if they develop a chronic illness, often they lose their job and thus lose their insurance. So is Medicaid a bulwark against that?
Medicaid really is. And I think it's been interesting watching this debate play out on a national level, where on the one hand, we have states that in many cases are trying to scale back these really effective Medicaid programs. On the other hand, we have people with private health insurance coverage who are struggling with deductibles and copayments that they simply cannot meet. And Medicaid has historically had very limited cost sharing for patients, so very limited premiums, very limited copayments, recognizing that Medicaid serves a population who's very much in or near poverty, and that even very low costs can present a barrier to care. So we've seen that when states expand Medicaid, the share of out-of-pocket spending for low-income people goes down significantly, and we see medical bankruptcies fall. We also, there's some preliminary evidence suggesting that because people are less likely to go into debt over healthcare, they're more likely to have better credit. And therefore, when they're trying to take out a loan for a house or a car, they're going to have a better interest rate. And so that sort of opens up a whole realm of far-reaching possibilities for families.
It's fascinating, the cascade effect.
Absolutely.
In other words, of how having some floor, some safety net of health insurance prevents these, you know, horrible health outcomes, let alone these financial outcomes.
Absolutely.
Which just stress everything else further.
Yeah, and so it's interesting watching some states trying to build greater cost sharing into their programs and this rhetoric that, like, you know, my health insurance requires me to jump through 18 hoops and also hit a pinata correctly before I can get coverage, and so therefore these people should too. And really it seems like if we're interested in having a system where we all have better health, the trick should be making sure that, you know, private health insurance instead is better protecting everyone and looking, in fact, more like Medicaid traditionally has.
I have read that there's a movement afoot to get an initiative, a statewide ballot initiative to expand Medicaid. In other words, our state legislature and our previous and current governor have not moved the needle on this at all. And yet it polls as a popular item. I think it's well north of 50%, closer to 60 or even over 60% of people that say, yes, let's expand Medicaid. And so I know there's a movement afoot to get this on the ballot. Tell us what you know about that.
So this has been really promising to watch play out over the last few years. In Maine, their then governor had pretty much stifled any attempts at Medicaid expansion for years. And so finally, Maine put it on the ballot and it passed overwhelmingly. And then the year after that, in 2018, three states, Idaho, Nebraska, and Utah, which are very much red states whose legislatures had refused to move, put it on the ballot and it cleared well in all those states. In Idaho, I think it was 61%. And so as a result, there's some folks in Oklahoma have filed an initiative petition to do something similar here. It is worth noting that the petition effort would be a constitutional, not statutory change, which does have a much higher signature threshold, and that'll be trickier for organizers to reach. But they're doing that because what we've seen in Idaho, Nebraska, and Utah is that even after these expansions passed, and they're very clean, they're very simple, the state simply adjusts its eligibility formula and people enroll, the state legislatures in these states have then gone back and tried to walk them back. So Idaho has said, what if we attached a work reporting requirement to this? Nebraska is currently saying, we can't actually do this until 2022 because it will be logistically too complicated to do what 34 other states did in like 2 years easily. And Utah, most perniciously, is trying to dial it back so that the state just gets like a set amount of money from the feds. And that's it. It's called a per capita cap. And the theory is that the state accepts less federal dollars and in return has more control over their program. But getting less federal dollars means that Utah is just going to be on the hook for a greater share of the costs over time. And that means that Utah gets to decide who they're going to kick off their health insurance. And so seeing that state legislatures have done that, I think is why the organizers in Oklahoma said, let's take the higher signature threshold and make this constitutional. Because given what other states have done, we don't want to create the opportunity for the legislature to try to take what people have voted on and do something different with it.
Wow. That is interesting.
So there was a court filing and the oral arguments are June 18th. And I think the expectation is that it'll be on the ballot sometime in 2020.
Oh, wait, what was the court filing? What was the challenge
to
it?
So the Oklahoma Council for Public Affairs filed a challenge. These are pretty normal, making a whole bunch of arguments about the petition. The AG, the Attorney General, has weighed in and said that the petition itself is fine, but he thinks the gist needs to be redone. It's not a binding opinion. It's just something for the court to consider, and arguments will happen later in June.
The gist of the language of the of the petition.
Yes. So the sort of blurb that people can read before they sign the petition.
Just arguing that the language isn't clear enough?
So the Medicaid expansion theoretically opens up, well, it does. It opens up coverage to people up to 133% of the federal poverty level, but Medicaid includes a 5% disregard. So it's practically 138% of the federal poverty level. And OCPA was arguing, and the Attorney General was agreeing, that the 133 versus 138 wasn't being made clear.
Was a significant enough difference to, okay. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Carly Putnam, who's policy director at the Oklahoma Policy Institute, where she is also the healthcare policy analyst in charge of that. And we're talking about healthcare in Oklahoma. We've talked extensively about Medicaid. But Carly, I want to ask you about the legislative session that just completed. I was reading in the newspaper, in the Tulsa World, there was this idea that came around that if people had returned mail, in other words, their healthcare authority, which is the agency that administers Medicaid, if they couldn't, their mail couldn't find them and it was returned, that they could be dropped from the rolls. And I think that was successfully fought, and the healthcare authority, I guess, rescinded that policy. But then at the end of the legislative session, we found out that that actually is in effect, so that if you are sent a piece of mail and you don't get it for one reason or another, then you're dropped from Medicaid.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Is there more to that story?
Not really. It's hard to say. So everything is filtered through, you know, I heard from the healthcare authority who says they heard from CMS, who knows.
CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services
federal
in
regulators,
Washington.
Yeah. Yes, I apologize. It's acronym okay. Central in the health policy world. And something that we have seen disturbingly over the last few years is CMS really encouraging states to be a lot more exacting in their eligibility and enrollment processes, which is something that can make sense in some states, But Oklahoma has been extensively audited by the feds. There are also extensive internal audits. And the quote-unquote improper payment rate, which is both basically things that should have been covered either accidentally or on purpose, is well below the national average. It's something like 3%. And so we're not seeing any evidence of the sort of issues that this program is supposed to address. The idea is that if people have moved, then they haven't updated the agency on their whereabouts. The agency can't verify that they're in the state, and therefore the agency needs to remove them from the rolls. We aren't seeing suggestions that this is actually an issue that needs to be addressed. I've been trying to come up with a better metaphor for this for a couple of years now, and I haven't, so we're going to go with the one I have, which is that it's a little bit like if you see a spider in your house and decide you need to burn your house down to deal with this problem, that in the efforts of trying to address one small issue, you wind up wrecking a system that works really well. Oklahoma has a pretty solid real-time eligibility determination system. When you go to apply for SoonerCare, which is the name of Oklahoma's Medicaid program, Wisconsin has Badger Care. Things could be much worse. you put in your info, and the system can tell you pretty much immediately if you qualify. And then it checks your data against a bunch of databases, you know, over the course of sometimes it's every week, sometimes it's every month, sometimes it's every other month, depending on exactly what data piece they're matching. And we have a system that works really well at healthcare conferences, health policy conferences I go to, at receptions. Around like the second glass of wine, people start finding me and telling me how good Oklahoma's enrollment system is. I'm not making this up. This has happened. And per issues like this and House Bill 1270, which was signed last year and sort of instigated this whole return mail policy, really are creating new barriers to eligibility and enrollment, to address an eligibility and enrollment problem that the state doesn't have. And we're seeing that in lots of states across the U.S. right now. It's really, really disappointing.
So on the legislative session, one of the key legislative pieces was Governor Stitt got these new and I think heretofore unprecedented powers of being able to appoint state agency heads. And so it becomes apparent that he's going to exert a lot more control, I think, over different agencies. And, of course, big ones in our state are the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, and of course, we've mentioned the Healthcare Authority, Oklahoma Healthcare Authority, which administers Medicaid. Neither of those agency heads actually changed. So I guess, what are your thoughts on his new appointment power?
I mean, it's a little bit disappointing to sort of recognize that in the future, agency heads can turn over as governors turn over, because I think something that Oklahoma has had going for it is that we've had agency heads who know their programs very, very well and who are basically appointed to be competent administrators of those programs, regardless of a particular agenda. And the governor absolutely has the ability to work with the legislature and through executive orders and just through the fact that they're the governor to work with agencies on things that they're particularly interested in pushing. But I think that it's been good for the Healthcare Authority and the Department of Health and Substance Abuse Services to know that their administrators are in charge because they are interested in the agency and not necessarily an agenda, which is not to say that if the governor goes through and makes appointments tomorrow that they're going to be political flunkies. I'm by no means saying that. It's just that it sort of creates the opportunity for the people running the agency to not necessarily be interested in the interests of the agency.
What other key pieces of healthcare legislation came out of the session that ended, you know, earlier this month?
Yeah, so we did see to go back to Medicaid expansion for the umpteenth time, we did see an expansion bill, Senate Bill 605 by Senator McCourtney, was assigned to committee, heard in committee, and passed unanimously out of committee, none of which has happened with an expansion bill, to my knowledge.
Passed unanimously out of committee, bipartisan basis.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, okay.
And then, fortunately, it then failed the next deadline. It was a pretty skinny bill. I think we described it as a good start, and we did feel it was a good start. But the author and leadership, I think, wanted more time to try to work on it before introducing it later in session. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. The governor now has said there will be a summer working group to work on developing a quote-unquote Oklahoma plan to be presented sometime this fall and then introduced in the 2020 legislative session, which could, interestingly, put it on a collision course with the ballot initiative.
Interesting.
So we could have dueling Medicaid measures, which is that's a good problem to have. I'll take it.
Right. Going,
I mean,
from,
ask me again in like September.
Right.
But
going from nothing, though, to, yeah, the conflicting problem. That's interesting. What else health-wise came out of the session?
It was a pretty quiet session on a number of fronts. We did see a bill to address what are called pharmacy benefit managers, which to sort of faceplant not super deep into the weeds, but a little bit into the weeds, are third-party groups that insurers work with to run their prescription drug programs. And so the PBMs, pharmacy benefit managers, healthcare policy is all about acronyms, in some cases will determine the formularies and sort of the stepped access to different kinds of drugs within their systems. And there's been, rightfully, I think, a lot of concern that their networks tend to be really narrow and they're not at all transparent. And so a bill was signed that I think will basically require these benefit managers to accept pharmacies that want to be part of their program into their program. The issue that legislators have talked about is rural areas where someone has a pharmacy in their town, but their health plan only covers the CVS 30 miles away. And so this, I believe, is intended to address that problem. And that's a good start. We're seeing a lot of state-level efforts on things like prescription drug access across the U.S.
Because PBMs are pretty much national platforms through these large insurance
groups. There's like three big ones.
Right. Yeah. And so I can see why either both a rural constituent who wants to get medicines that doesn't necessarily have access, although I guess you could say mail order would be the solution to that, but who wants to, it's also probably beneficial for the local pharmacy, the small, you know, retail local pharmacy who wants to get in on the plan, which I think is good. And I read something where, you know, maybe that was a desired goal of this piece of legislation. So do you think it'll have much practical effect to help small business owners, small pharmacists?
I hope so.
Okay.
I mean, I think we'll see what happens as it plays out.
Anything else from the legislation?
We did see some funding increases. This session was interesting just in that, you know, last year we had the special sessions that went on forever and then the teacher walkout. And this year we weren't staring a glaring budget hole in the face, which was a really interesting situation to be in. And so I think we started to see some reversal of the long-term underfunding that we'd seen for the prior decade. So the healthcare authority did get money for a rate increase, and the legislature actually created a fund to basically stock up dollars for when the federal Medicaid match eventually drops, which it will, to try to protect those provider rates, which is really good for these providers' businesses. We also saw the there's about 5,500 people with disabilities on a waiting list for home and community-based services. And the average wait time right now, I think, is about 12 years.
12 years?
12 years. And the legislature put about $2 million towards that, which I believe is anticipated to move about 200 people off the waiting list. So that's a start. For the other 5,300, you know, it's still a long wait. But I know the developmental disability community has been really active in working with legislators. There's a waiting list caucus even. And so seeing attention here, I think, is it's not enough, but it's a start.
Carly Putnam is the policy director and a healthcare policy analyst at the Oklahoma Policy Institute. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our shows, you can stream them online anytime on a smartphone, tablet, or a computer. Just try our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.